Welcome to In Season, where we explore connections between people, land, plants, and wildlife here in the Lower Columbia Pacific region. I'm Teresa Retzloff, and joining me in the studio today is a dear friend, an amazing textile artist and gardener, grower of plants, Britt Bowles. Welcome, Britt.
Thank you so much, Teresa. Thanks for having me.
We are going to be exploring the topic of natural dyes today. There are so many plants that you would never even think can produce the most amazing colors. And in getting to know Britt over the years, she has introduced me to so many plants that I'm growing on my farm that I didn't know I could make the most amazing colors out of. And then she's also talked me into growing some things that has really blown my mind about the possibilities of this. And these are really fun plants to incorporate into your gardens. Some of them are super easy to use. Some of them are very complicated. So we're going to dig into all of that. But Britt, tell us a little bit about how you got interested in dye plants. I mean, that's a pretty specific group of plants to be growing.
Great question. Yeah, thanks for having me, Teresa. So about 11 years ago, I was postpartum with my daughter, and I'm a musician by trade and had a long standing relationship with the garden thanks to my parents. Growing up, I was homeschooled. It meant right after noon, I would be sent out of doors and then a bell would be rung when it was time to come in. So I was in the garden a lot growing up. Just observing plants, I think, is a really special place to be. It's a special place to grow up as a backyard kid. Really lucky, really privileged to have that opportunity. But it really wasn't until as an adult, as a mother, having created something really beautiful, this beautiful new life, I was looking for a creative juice, something new to flow into my life. And I just happened upon, thanks to the world of social media, other artists and folks who were using natural dyes. And it had occurred to me before that you could use plants and other items to dye cloth. I had done, you know, some Easter egg things, just little experiments in the kitchen, right?
I feel like that's a good starter pack for people with natural dyes.
Yeah.
You do Easter eggs.
You do Easter
little
eggs.
Little onion skins, yep, or other stuff.
And exactly. The turmeric, the coffee, mm-hmm, the berries, right? I think everyone has had that experience, and everyone's also stained their white shirt, right? With berries, with grass, etc. We've all done some natural dyeing.
Unintentionally.
Unintentionally, exactly. So what really struck me, though, was the indigo plant. That's what lured me in first. That was the gateway, if you will. And I thought, is anyone growing this where I live? And I don't think anyone nearby me is growing it, but maybe. Let's look. I was lucky enough to find a farmer named Kara Gilbert, and she is growing on Vibrant Valley Farm on Sauvie Island, and was in her first year growing this indigo plant that I was so keen on learning more about. An indigo is special because it's a green plant. It's a very, it just looks like basil. Nothing special when
it
you walk
like
by it.
It looks like a weed.
Yeah,
let's
like a weed.
Let's be honest. It looks like smartweed.
It does.
People know what smartweed is. It looks so much like that. When I first had it growing on my farm, I was terrified.
Right. Well, it's in that family, believe it or not. So that species, Persicaria maculosa, that's the smartweed. So this is Persicaria tinctoria. And that tinctoria is actually a clue whenever you're looking up the kind of the Latin name of plants. If it has that tint or tinctoria in it, that's a hint that it's probably a dye-producing plant. So you'll find that, like Rubia tinctorium, Persicaria tinctoria, those are all dye plants. So this indigo plant was growing fresh on Kara's farm. She was so generous, immediately willing to share information with me, share plant with me, share seed with me, share knowledge, and an instant connection for collaboration and how can we make this an opportunity for community, really, is what it started as. And that's blossomed into now partnerships here locally with other farmers, with you, mm-hmm, thankfully, and also with another artist that this radio station is familiar with, I'm sure. She had a radio show here, Iris Sullivan Dare, another fiber artist and weaver. We collaborate on a project called Indigo Fest, and it's in its seventh year. hosting every August at the Sou'wester in Seaview, Washington. So that's the short story.
I mean, it is fascinating to me, and it was funny. It's such a slippery slope because I'd heard about, you know, your work. I'd heard about the indigo dyeing. I was kind of like slightly curious because plants interest me, and I mean, I love to grow plants. Obviously, on my farm is what I do, but I mostly was like food plants, produce, or cut flowers. But I wasn't really thinking about this as a group of plants. You know, I'm familiar with medicinal herbs, and so like that plants have different uses. But and I don't even remember how I said yes to like, oh, I could grow some indigo on the farm. Let's, you know, you were looking for another, like a more local source of fresh, you know, and I was curious about it and you got me some seeds. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it was started out with just this little vial of seeds that I got from you. And I was like, I'm going to see what they look like. And again, I was terrified when they started growing because they do look like a weed. But I planted them out. And I remember the first time you came out to harvest at the farm and it was wild. I mean, you're picking them, you're like mashing these leaves up in your palm. It's turning, you know, turquoise, green. Mm-hmm. You're like, taste it, like shoving it in my mouth. Oh, do you have an insect bite? Rub it on your insect bite. It's really good for that. And then I was actually hosting a outdoor painting group at that day. And so you were going around and like making like watercolor pigment for people to like splash on their paper and like throwing bits of cloth into like a Ziploc bag with some leaves and mashing it up. And it was coming out all these amazing colors. And I was just like so blown away by all the things you could do with this one plant. Mm-hmm. And that's even just the most simple form of dyeing with that plant. That's not like going on to the more complicated, like fermented vats where you get these amazing blue colors that come out of it. So that's a huge learning process, right? But you can, like that one plant, you can do so much different stuff with it is really amazing. And then I got curious and I'm like, well, what other plants are there? And so tell me about some of your favorite plants. But I mean, indigo, we'll talk more about that. Mm-hmm. But like, what are some other like, you know, easy plants, good plants, plants that produce some amazing colors? What are some of your favorites?
Great question. So I think it's helpful to know that there's kind of three categories when it comes to the dye plant world. Often people are wondering when I go and I look outside around me, what's a dye plant? Is there one specific category? And there's kind of three main ones. We call them substantive, adjective, and fugitive. And we know the fugitive ones really well because we've stained ourselves with these. So we're talking about berries and beets, right? The beet juice and the berry juice and the chlorophyll from the grass. That's a grass stain, right? So anthocyanins are a really good example of fugitive chemicals. Fugitive meaning they're on the run, right? They're not here to stay. They're here for a short time, not a long time, here for a good time, here for a party. Great for Easter egging, right? But not good for long-term cloth if you want sustainable color.
So they might get a really bright color from it, but then it's going to fade.
Yeah, it can either fade through the sun. It could fade through washing and drying. Sometimes just simply sitting out and oxidizing, that pink changes to a gray, right, over time. So those plants we call fugitive chemicals. Many plants have these fugitive chemicals, and many plants have more than one chemical. We're not just looking at indigotin when we're looking at the indigo plant. It has indigotin chemicals in it that have the possibility, the potential to be blue, but they also contain flavonoids. And we probably know about flavonoids because you hear it said in the health world, like, oh, flavonoids are good for you. They're in every grain plant, right? Every veggie has packed full of flavonoids. Those things are really good for you. And they also produce yellow pigments. And some produce really strong yellow pigments, like luteolins. And some are weaker, so they're not going to hang around as long. And some of those dyes need an assist, an adjective. And that adjective in the dye world is a mordant. And a mordant is something that adheres to the cloth. It's a preparation, a pre-preparation before dyeing. So we prepare the cloth with a mordant. Then it will actually chemically react with our dye molecules like luteolins from marigolds and weld, or alizarin from madder, or the purpurins from madder. So we have these different chemical molecules that actually form a bond with that mineral mordant that we treat our cloth with.
And so that's how the colors will stay more permanent?
Exactly.
Could you, if you're using the fugitive colors, will mm-hmm. the fugitive colors become more permanent if you use a mordant, or are they just still fugitive?
They can sometimes take on a stronger bond with a mordant, but inherently those chemical molecules are not going to attach as well with those fugitive chemicals that I mentioned, like anthocyanins.
So you need a plant that's got, it's more inclined for its colors mm-hmm. to stick around, and then you yeah. have to do this cloth preparation. So that's yeah. the thing. You can't just like take a t-shirt and throw it in a bath of, you know, some dye thing and right. have it work.
There's it's generally some to. Preparation yeah. involved. And that could be the scouring process, which is a form of cleaning that fiber properly and removing all oils and lanolins and, you know, any, you know, kind of unseen substances. A lot of times when we're buying commercial fibers, they're pre-treated with sizings. And so those sizings can actually repel and become preventative in our dye process. So we actually have to remove those before we can treat our cloth for the dye process. There's some really rare dyes in the substantive world. They're like, they're the main subject. They don't need anything else. They don't need an assist, like indigo. Indigo doesn't need a mordant assist. It actually forms a physical bond. So these dye molecules are actually getting trapped in the fiber, weaving their way through the fiber, attaching in long chains, like barbell-shaped chains, to each other, and they get trapped in the fiber. And that is how they form a bond with the fiber without that mordant assist. So those are kind of the three categories. We have subjective, adjective, and fugitive dyes. What's great is nowadays we have a lot of dedicated farms, seed farmers like some of the good folks at Grand Prismatic Seed, who have dedicated sections to dye farming. So you can go on their website and look at dye plants, and you know you're getting productive plants. You know you're getting plants that are good for dyeing cloth and fibers, like marigolds, like weld, like madder, like
there's
indigo.
Coreopsis.
Oh, coreopsis is beautiful
and
for prints.
And scabiosa, that black yeah. scabiosa.
Black night scabiosa.
Oh, they're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I mean, sometimes the plant itself, the color of the plant, it's not what you think
yeah.
it's going to turn into. And that's kind of mind-blowing as well. And it can be really fun. And you've also done, I've seen you do things where you take flowers and like pound mm-hmm. them. Like mm-hmm. you put a cloth on top of it and then take a hammer or
exactly.
like a mallet. Maybe not a metal hammer, but like a soft mallet or something, and then pound it. And the colors like imprint on the fabric.
Yes.
Which is a different way of dyeing, but you get this like ghost print of a flower, and that's so cool.
Yeah, that process I've learned through, there's a Japanese art called tatakazome, and it comes from the really old practice of pounding and hammering plants and leaves onto washi paper, and then that moved into hammering those plants and leaves onto fibers themselves. And actually, I'll be showcasing this technique at the Hoffman in December. I'm doing a little show, a collaborative show at the Hoffman. If anyone is local and interested in Manzanita, you'll be able to see some of my tatakazome print style on fiber.
It's so fascinating. I mean, that just, it, and because it can be as simple as you want it to be, and it can be as elaborate as you want it to
yes.
be.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, I find it really fun. It's a way of like playing with these plants, being creative with them, seeing what happens with them. And I find that I look at plants differently now because there's a curiosity of wondering, like, I wonder if I could, you know, will you make a color? Can mm. you dye with this plant? Mm-hmm. Is it something that's going to, you know, what will happen if, you know, you make a tea out of this and then, you know, put a silk handkerchief in it? What can happen? That was cool too. So talk about like silk. Mm-hmm. as a fiber mm-hmm. too, because that mm-hmm. you said you didn't have to treat it as much for some dyes.
Yeah, what's fascinating about this world of natural dyes is that it inevitably bleeds into the world of natural fibers, because natural dyes coexist alongside of natural fibers, and they always have, right? There's the dyes of antiquity, right? Anything dyed before 1850 was dyed naturally. We've been naturally dyeing with plants longer than we have with synthetics, right? It's really, we don't think about it because it's all we know when we go to the store, right? We just see a lot of synthetic fibers, some natural fibers still, but a lot of synthetics and almost 100% synthetic dyes, right? But that's a really recent new thing, right? Those were really like recent new, sometimes accidental discoveries in the chemistry world. But anything in a museum, you know, that's older than 1850, right, is dyed naturally. It's dyed with...
so mind-blowing. When you think about the vibrant colors yeah. that still exist in like old textiles and old fabrics.
Oh, absolutely.
That color is still around and that it came from a plant or a sea creature or something.
Right. Wow. They're extremely potent. Yeah.
It is amazing. If you are just joining us here on today's in-season program on KMUN, I am speaking with Britt Bowles. She is a natural fiber and natural dye artist. And we're talking about natural dye plants and, you know, what are good ones to grow in your garden? How, you know, are there, you know, how do you learn how to use them? I mean, there's a lot of resources out there now. Mm. I imagine mm-hmm. so many more than when you first got started, and you've created some of these resources as well. So you have a website. Tell people what that is.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'd actually started as a Facebook group. When I first started growing natural dyes, thanks to Ginger at North Fork 53 Farm, which was in Nehalem, I really knew instantaneously that I needed and wanted community to be a part of this process, because the act of extracting pigment on a large scale from indigo plants takes a team of people to harvest, and it takes a team of people often to process. And it's not necessarily an intuitive thing, meaning I don't have something to compare it to in the rest of my life that's adjacent to that, that I can go, oh yeah, it's kind of like this. It's really very much existing in its own little world. Mm-hmm. So in order to kind of resource community and resources, you know, knowledge, I had to reach out to the larger community online on Facebook. And a Facebook group became a way for me to say, okay, we're all doing this thing. We just picked indigo. Now, what do we do with it? What's step one and what's step two? And what does it look like? How do we know when it's ripe? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? All these questions that we were really kind of creating our own library of experiential knowledge for. And it was a way to document that and also easily share, because we were all in different timelines, right? So it started off in this little local Facebook group. And that has... now, I guess 7 or 8 years later, become a more global group with over 16,000 people, but all people who are very pointedly there for the reason of sharing about indigo plant processes. So these are growers. These are farmers. These are people in their backyards and on their farms, people who come from all sorts of different cultures, all sorts of different indigo bearing plants. What's really neat about indigo in particular is that there is an indigo bearing species on every continent. So simultaneously, global cultures all created their own methods and systems for how to treat their indigo plant, their native indigo. And so we get to learn collectively from all of these different systems, all of these different communal knowledges. And a lot of them, like you mentioned, you asked, where do you go for resources, aren't written down. They're oral. They're stories, right?
That's amazing and wonderful to hear those stories, but that mm-hmm. does make it challenging.
It does make it challenging, yeah. During COVID, I actually started a series called Blue Biographies because we were all trapped at home. So I interviewed 39 different growers and artisans around the globe talking about why indigo, what are they doing with it? How do they, you know, get into the practice of working with those plants? So that Facebook group is called Indigo Pigment Extraction Methods. Anyone can join. You don't have to be an indigo grower, but we're there to talk very specifically about indigo if it piques your interest. We're nerds about that. We get into the chemistry. It's where people go to ask questions. Where do I get seeds? What's going on? How do I tell if my extraction's done? What else can I do with this plant? So there's artists there who are painters. There's people who are working with wood and fiber, all sorts of different mediums, not just strictly fiber artists. But what I love about the community is we're all growers. We're there because we love the plant process. Yeah. And now there's a website you can visit, indigofest.org, and that has all the information about Indigo Fest event in August, which is the 3rd through 7th at the Southwestern in Seaview, Washington. And it's also where you can find an online course that I host called Intuitive Indigo. It teaches people how to make their own indigo vat. Four different ways, if they're using their own pigment or if they're purchasing it online from another source.
Because you can also, I mean, so a lot of these plants, you can extract a dried pigment mm-hmm. from them. And mm-hmm. then, so you could be using a dried powder.
Yeah, an extract.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. also you can grow the plant yourself.
Exactly.
And just, so, it has been really fascinating for me. And I keep really trying to resist getting sucked into this world because I have so many other things I'm growing and focusing on, but it's really hard not to, because I have so much curiosity about it. So last year I ended up growing a lot of marigolds because mm-hmm. they're very beautiful and I love working with them. But also I knew that it was a dye plant and you were kind of luring me into that world as well. You are such a Pied Piper. It's dangerous. And then we did a fun workshop together last fall. And you had made this huge vat, and it was really just like a garland of dried marigolds mm-hmm. that you basically made a tea
exactly.
out of. And you cooked it and soaked it and, you know, boiled it for quite a while. And it was this beautiful, deep golden color.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had these just little silk handkerchiefs that we dropped into it and let them roll yes. around in there for quite a while. And they came out and they were the most beautiful gold color.
Yeah.
And completely color fast.
Yes, yes. And I did treat those with a mordant. So I pre-prepared those. Thanks for circling me back to the silk question.
Yeah. So like that, I mean, it was so fascinating to me. Again, like this amazing color out of this mm-hmm. plant that I'd kind of taken for granted for a while. I mean, it's like big orange marigold. You know, I mean, it seems like such a common plant. Mm-hmm, and then to mm-hmm. see like, oh, wow, but you can really do this cool thing with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also love the seasonality of those things. There's different times when certain plants are available to you, and that makes it really special because, you know, I've got fresh marigolds right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the equinox. What does that time mean? What are the micro seasons? What's happening? What are those smells? What are those, you know, kind of environmental reminders for me? What are those lessons in the garden that always, you know, it has to teach us all those metaphoric life lessons, right? So I love that there's this ritual now, right? We're doing it again. We're doing marigold equinox again in September. And if folks want to come, you can follow us on Instagram at @cspellfiber to find out about that. But what's lovely is there's just a certain amount of time where I get fresh indigo, right? And the rest of the season, if I've extracted pigment, I can use that pigment later. But you really appreciate and you develop a very intimate relationship with these plants on another level. It's more than just, oh, marigold is a beautiful flower and I can string it up and have it as a garland. And there's so many rituals attached to those marigolds, right? But the visceralness of having the plant relationship, having that fresh plant growing, where I can rip off those petals, mash them up, hammer them directly, make a tea, drink the tea. It's edible also, right? But also die with it. That's such a really unique experience.
I love seasonality in plants too. I mean, there is something so wonderful about that kind of fleeting nature of something being in season where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to take advantage of it in that moment. And I know we've become so jaded in some ways because so much is like you can get, you know, fresh strawberries in January. You could get mm-hmm. fresh marigolds in December if you were willing to pay enough for them, right? You know, they can come from all over the world. We have such a global economy now. But you're right. There is a flavor to something that is fresh. There is a sensation to something that is fresh. That's just come from like you going out into your garden and picking it
mm-hmm.
that really is kind of magical. And and it is so precious because it can be quite a short
mm-hmm.
time of year that it's available. And the more that I farm, the more that I grow plants, the more I appreciate the fact that I only get to have this thing for a certain amount of time and then it goes away for a while. And mm-hmm. then I get excited about it. I mean, I've got tons of indigo seedlings and marigold seedlings and other things growing in my high tunnel right now, my greenhouse, that we're getting ready to plant out in the next few weeks. And I'm so excited to see them. Mm-hmm. It's like, welcome back. Hey, mm-hmm. Hey, it's nice to see you again. You know? And I'm curious about what we'll do with them this year. So it's I hope that people can explore this and even just try a little bit, learn mm-hmm. a little bit about it, because it is such a fascinating way. It's a fun thing to do with kids too. If you're looking so for like fun. Summer activities yeah. with kids, these are some really fun things. So I just, are there, if people are curious about mm-hmm. this, I mean, you mentioned Grand Prismatic Seed. They're mm-hmm. a great resource for dye plants. Are there mm-hmm. books that you recommend? Mm-hmm. Are there websites? Like, if people want to learn more, I mean, yeah. just like, you know, the internet search is your friend, and absolutely. There's a lot of resources out there. But if you were going to direct someone, like, where would you send them?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, locally, you'll be able to get some, I think, fresh buckets from Teresa.
This is true. I am really trying to make this yeah. available. Yeah. So check out, you know, you could follow our farm. So we'll be selling some fresh indigo this year. So if you want to find out more about that, you can, you know, yeah. email my farm, find out about that, and, yeah. and we'll be making that available to people.
Yeah.
If you want to experiment with growing with fresh indigo, but you don't want to grow it yourself.
Exactly, right. And what's really cool and unique about that is once you buy that plant from Teresa, it propagates in water. In about 4 days, you'll have new roots. In about 10 days, you'll have new leaves. You'll have indigo plants. This isn't just like a cut flower where you cut it, you have it for a week or so, and the plant dies. This plant can live on through the season. It is frost tender. That means it's not going to become an invasive weed in your yard, luckily. It's going to have an annual life where you'll yeah. need to collect seeds and then plant it again in the spring. But yeah, beyond the local connection, if you're looking for dye extracts, Botanical Colors out of Seattle, Washington is a great resource, not just for dye stuffs and fiber, but also for classes. I teach an online class with them, and they have a website, botanicalcolors.com. A great book if you're going to your library, your local library, and you want to check out a book. Lots of good ones. One that comes to mind is The Art and Science of Natural Dyes by Catherine Ellis and Joy Buttrop. That's a really great start if you want to get into how do I prepare my fiber? How do I make a dye bath?
Because there's a few steps you need to follow, but like mm-hmm. once you've done it, like then you know.
Yeah.
And it can become easier each time. So it is such a fascinating topic. Britt, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your knowledge with us. I hope people are inspired to maybe try a little bit of natural dye, or maybe you're just going to do Easter eggs again next year or something, but just like get out there and learn all the different ways, the things that plants can do. It's so amazing.
It's so inspiring. It's another way to connect in the garden and really express that creativity. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks.
It's been a really great conversation. And I want to say thank you so much to Matt, our new program director, for engineering for us today.
Thanks, Matt.
It's really cool to meet him and welcome him to the KMUN family. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. And we'll talk to you next month.
We'll see you in the garden.
Yeah.